Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 10. This will be the story of David defeating the Ammonites and their Syrian allies. Our context is this. In chapter 9, the previous chapter, David has shown a lot of kindness to Mephibosheth, giving him lands, giving him a seat at his table, and so forth. Mephibosheth being the son of Jonathan, David's old friend, during the times when Saul was king, Jonathan being Saul's son, who was killed at the Battle of Gilboa. Mephibosheth was there at the battle. His nurse ran him away when it was apparent that the Israeli army was doomed and his father was dead. She dropped him. His two feet were lame. But David nonetheless shows him kindness. So that was the last chapter. Now we're here on 2 Samuel chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Now it happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun his son became king in his place. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent some of his servants to console him, to console Hanun, concerning his father Nahash. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, and I'll stop it there in the middle of a verse. Verse 1 says, now it happened afterwards. Now for some time orientation here, this is apparently referring back to 2 Samuel 8, 11, and 12, which is apparently spoken in anticipation of what's happening in this chapter. 2 Samuel 8, 11, and 12 says this, King David also dedicated these to the Lord with the silver and gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Aram and Moab, and the sons of Ammon. So there's the sons of Ammon, and later we'll see Ammon had Syrian allies from Aram, Syria, and also the Philistines and Amalek and the spoils of Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. All of that sounds like a preface to what we're going to see in detail in this chapter. Now, of course, the afterwards could just be a general reference to what happened after David showed kindness to Mephibosheth. But at any rate, the time is not all that important here. The king of the Ammonites died. Now, the king's name was Nahash, and that's probably the same Nahash that Saul defeated at Jabesh-Gilead. If you recall, in 1 Samuel 11, 1 through 2, Saul's very first battle as king when he took over was against this Nahash the Ammonite. Let me read that, 1 Samuel 11, 1 and 2. Now, Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. Jabesh-Gilead is to the north of Ammon, to the east of the Jordan River, in Manasseh, east of Manasseh. Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us, and we will serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. Now remember, Jabesh-Gilead belonged to Israel, and Saul was trying to be the king of Israel to defend Israel, and so he had to do something about this nasty covenant that Nahash had made with the Israelite town of Jabesh-Gilead. You got to cut your eye out so you won't have one-eyed soldiers not going to be able to fight. That's why they did that sort of thing. And Saul didn't like that. And so in 1 Samuel 11, 11, the next morning Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp at the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. Total victory over Nahash. Now, David, of course, is Saul's enemy, and so it's understandable that Nahash, after this horrible defeat by Saul, would be friendly with David. In verse 2, David says, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as Hanun's father Nahash showed kindness to me. So we don't know, it's not recorded anywhere, where Nahash showed kindness to David. It would not be surprising, of course, because Nahash is not going to be friends with Saul, and David was the enemy of Saul. Now, some people speculate that the kindness that Nahash had showed David was when David had deposited his parents for safekeeping in Moab, Mizpah of Moab. You recall that when David was on the run from Saul. And since Ammon is right north of Moab, that Nahash, the king of Ammon, might have visited Moab and seen David at that time. But that's just a total speculation, even though it's mentioned by Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Clark has the right idea here. He says, quote, we do not know exactly the nature or extent of the obligation which David was under to the king of the Ammonites. No, we don't, and so we don't care, do we? Now, let's do a little bit of geography here. Where are the Ammonites? Well, if you look at the Jordan River that runs from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, if you look right at the tip, the northern tip of the Dead Sea, and go east through the Araba Valley, the Jordan River Valley, till you hit the range of mountains there and go right past the mountains down on the other side of the mountains, that's the southern border of the tribe of Gad, which is on in east, the eastern side of the Jordan River. And if you go north along the eastern border of Gad, you will hit the Jabbok River. And then if you turn and go west along the Jabbok River, that's the northern border of Gad. And the Jabbok River then runs back into the Jordan. So that's Gad. Now, if you go directly to the east of Gad, you're at Ammon, at least as Ammon was constituted during this period of time. Jabesh Gilead is north of Ammon in East Manasseh. So we've set the scene here geographically. So now David says, I'm going to send some of my people up to Hanan, the surviving son of Nahash, to console him. That was probably a political move. I want to keep him on my side. He's been allied with me. I want to be allied with him. I don't think it was anything personal that David felt a whole lot of grief over Nahash dying. So David sends his servants up, and we go down to 2 Samuel 10:3 through 4. And by the way, where were the servants sent? Well, the capital city of Ammon is Rabbath, or sometimes it's called Rabbath Ammon, or Rabbath Ammon. And that is the name of Ammon. That's the ancient city, which is today Ammon, the capital of Jordan, which has an airport. I mean, you know, it's still there. And that's probably where David sent his messengers to console Hanan, the son of Nahash. We go now to 2 Samuel 10, verses 3 and 4. The princes of the Ammonites said to Hanan, their lord, do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search the city, to spy it out and overthrow it? So Hanan took David's servants and shaved off half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. Now, that seems sort of harsh of the Ammonites, but they might have had reason to be suspicious of David. If they were familiar with the Israelite law, they could have read in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. Because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. That was the famous incident in the plains of Moab. You recall that story. And we usually think it's the Moabites who did that. But the Ammonites were allied with the Moabites, as were the Amalekites, as were the Midianites. Deuteronomy 23, verse 5 continues, nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. Verse 6, you shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. So the law was very clear. The Ammonites are bad guys, and so it would be understandable that Hanan's counselor said, man, you're taking a big risk letting these consolers come into Rabbath Ammon. They might spy out our city, and then they might overthrow it. Jameson Fawson Brown says, quote, their suspicion was not warranted either by any overt act or by any cherished design of David. It must have originated in their knowledge of the denunciation of God's law against them. And then JFB cites the passage in Deuteronomy I just read, Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 6. Now, here's a good place to go on a rabbit trail. This has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about now, but I can't help but bring it up. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3 says, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, none of their descendants, even to the 10th generation. No Ammonite shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. King James translate that not ever as forever. They shall forever not enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, this is one of the many examples where forever doesn't literally mean forever. In other words, they're going to inhabit the land forever. And I can hear dispensationalists say, see there? That means that Israel is going to have a millennial Jewish kingdom in the millennium because forever means forever. Well, for one thing, it can't mean literally forever because the Jews didn't hold the land from 70 A.D. all the way to 1948 A.D. That's one little problem right there. But also that word forever doesn't mean forever. It means a long time. And here we see the word forever being connected with even to the 10th generation. That's not forever. That's only for 10 generations. It just means a long time. Doesn't mean forever. You can look that up in a Hebrew lexicon, too, and come up with the same thing. Also, the suspicion may have originated, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, in David's policy and steadfastly adhering to it. Well, I don't know. How steadfast is David adhering to the policy when he sends consolers up to Rabbah to console Nahum? Well, he probably, what is meant here by him strictly adhering to the law is that David had not let any Ammonite enter into the Jewish assembly, any political meetings of the Jews. So anyway, that's not surprising. They're upset. But this was stupid. Hanun took the ambassadors, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips, and sent them away. That was stupid, because that's obviously going to make an enemy out of David. Kind of like the Germans in World War I engaging in unrestricted submarine warfare against American merchant marine ships. Stupid, because it raised the sleeping giants, just like the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. Countries tend to get upset about things like that. So they did the same stupid thing. They provoked a military enemy that was much stronger than them. Well, what did they do? The first thing they did is they took David's ambassadors and they shaved half their beard off. Now, this was a terrible humiliation to the Israelite ambassadors. Might not be to us in our culture. We think, well, big deal. The other half will grow back. Let's let it go. No, the beards to Israelite men were, according to the NIV Study Bible, were symbols of dignity, manhood, maturity, and freedom. In fact, men who were taken as slaves were shaved to show that they were no longer free. Adam Clark says men would often swear by their beard. I swear by my beard I will not attack you. Adam Clark says also sometimes men would pledge their beards in matters of great importance. I just borrowed $1 million from you. I'll give you as collateral my beard. Folks, beards meant a lot back then. We have to do some cross-cultural understanding here. The Spartans used to shave half their beards of their soldiers who ran from battle as a mark of or an emblem of shame. So that was bad enough. But then the next thing that Hanun did, and Hanun's men did, is they cut off David's ambassador's garments in the middle as far as their hips. Now what that means is since they had no Fruit of the Looms back then, no BVDs, no Hanes underwear, they cut their robes off so that their private parts were exposed to public view. And then they sent them back to David. I'm sure they were laughing and jeering, as Gill says. Again, stupid. So the men were not only shamed by having their beards and their clothes cut off, their private parts showing, their beards cut, but they just plain looked ridiculous as they walked back to Jerusalem. We go now to 2 Samuel 10, verse 5. When this was reported to David, he sent someone to meet them. Since they were deeply humiliated, the king said, "Stay in Jericho until your beards grow back, then return." Now it was reported to David what had happened. He didn't actually see the shaved beards and the cut tunics. So somebody must have reported it to him. And then David said, "Well, I'm going to send somebody out to meet them before they get back to Jerusalem." Why? Well, perhaps the ambassadors were too ashamed to show up in Jerusalem looking like they did. I don't know. But David's motives probably were maybe to send them some new clothes, as John Gill says. Although it seems to me that the ambassadors would have found new clothes somewhere before they got back to Jerusalem. They wouldn't have walked all the way naked. They couldn't have grown their beards back, but they could have found some clothes. So, but maybe David sent them some new clothes, but maybe David sent them some new clothes. But by going out to meeting his ambassadors or sending someone to meet the ambassadors, it would shorten their humiliating journey back to Jerusalem. So that was nice of David. And then David said through his messengers to the ambassadors, "Hey, guys, with your beards cut off, stay in Jericho until your beards grow back. Then you can come back to Jerusalem. You won't be ashamed then." Now, of course, Jericho had been destroyed by Joshua, the famous story of marching around the wall 7 times, you recall. But as John Gill points out, Jericho may have had cottages nearby for the convenience of shepherds or fruit gatherers. The fact that Jericho had not been rebuilt yet made it comparatively private. That would help these humiliated ambassadors be able to find a private place to grow their beards back. Adam Clark says, quote, "This city had not been rebuilt since the time of Joshua, but there were, no doubt, many cottages still remaining and larger dwellings also, but the walls had not been repaired." Now, an interesting side point here is that this incident proves that the Israelites wore beards. If the Israelites were clean-shaven, the ambassadors would have just come home and shaved the other half off and fit in right in with the rest of the Israelites. But since they had to grow their beards back, that shows that the custom was for the Israelites to wear beards. All right, now we're going to go to 2 Samuel 10:6, and we're going to run into a lot of geography. I'll try to make some sense out of it for you. Now, when the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David, and I don't think it probably took them too long to figure that out, the sons of Ammon sent and hired the Arameans of Beth-Rehob and the Arameans of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. That's T-O-B. I don't know. I never know whether to pronounce that Tob to make it rhyme with Job or Tob to make it rhyme with Job. I'm going to say Tob. I think it sounds better. Now, let's look at the geography here. I'm going to drop down to the south to a place that's not mentioned in our verses here, but is mentioned actually in Chronicles, where the battle with the Ammonites took place, Medeba. Now, Medeba is to the south of Ammon. Remember, you look at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, go east about 10-15 miles or so, and you get to the border of Ammon. You go east those 15 miles, that's the tribe of Gad, and then you get to Ammon, which is the north-south border of Ammon. Now, at the very southern end of Ammon is a town called Medeba. That's where the battle took place. Medeba is about 18, 19, maybe 20 miles southwest of Rabbah, the capital of Ammon. Now, I'm going to go north from Medeba. We go from Medeba to Rabbah. We're in Ammon. You go right north until you get to the Jabbok River, go north of the Jabbok River, and you're in the land of Tob. So that's the first ally, the Syrians in the land of Tob. There's a highway that runs up from Medeba to Rabbath Ammon, present-day Ammon, Jordan. And you go up from Ramon to another famous place, Ramoth-Gilead, which is not the same place as Ramoth-Ammon. I have a horrible time keeping them straight in my mind. Ramoth-Gilead is northwest about 15 miles. Northeast about 15 miles, but it's on the same road. The King's Highway, that road is called. Right around the land of Ramoth-Gilead is perhaps the land of Tob. It's got a question mark on my Bible Atlas.map. This is right around the sources of the Yarmouk River, which eventually flows into the Jordan River right south of the Sea of Galilee. The Yarmouk River flows through Edrei, which is where a big battle was when Moses clobbered the people of Bashan, Og of Bashan, if you recall that battle. So we're in somewhat familiar territory here. All right, that's the land of Tob. They were allied with the Ammonites. I assume these people were Syrians. We're getting up towards Syria. All right, you keep going up the road. You go past the Golan Heights, Geshur, it's called, and you are basically in the tribe of East Manasseh. Geshur is the Golan Heights right east of the Sea of Galilee. You go, let's go to the Sea of Galilee and go up the Jordan River to Little Lake Hula, which is about 5 miles or so north of the Sea of Galilee. And then you go about 10 more miles north, and you're right at the foot of snowy Mount Hermon. That place is called Maacah. Maacah. Now, Maacah is right at the opening mouth, the southern end of Kole, Syria, which is the area between the two Lebanon ranges. The Lebanon range, which runs north to south through present-day Lebanon, and the anti-Lebanon range, which runs north to south in present-day Lebanon. And between those two mountains is Kole, Syria. The Latani River runs out of that area southwards to the Sea of Galilee. You go up the valley a little bit, and there's the Orontes River. It runs northward and then back west toward the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. So that's Maacah. These are all Syrian areas. I mean, it was allotted to the Israelites, but they hadn't managed to run them out yet. So these are Syrian areas. Now, if you're at Maacah and you're right at the southern end of the Mount Hermon, which is the southern tip of the Anti-Lebanon Range, you go east. You get on the other side of the Anti-Lebanon Range, and that's Zobah. Well, I don't know if you can keep all this straight. It's hard when you don't have a map to look at. But if you'll look at all of these Syrian allies, they make a perfect circle around Israel. Oh, I left out Beth-Rehob. Beth-Rehob is in Naphtali, which is right southwest of Maacah. That's actually on the west side of the Jordan River, still north of Lake Hula. But if you start with Beth-Rehob, go up to Maacah, go east to Zobah, go south to Tob. Those are all Syrian allies, which perfectly encircle Israel. So it made a lot of sense what they were doing. The stupid thing they did was to provoke David. But then they got some alliances. They're basically mercenaries. And mercenaries are not the best troops, but they still had some troops. By the way, Makkah means oppression. A great name. I wonder why people would name their tribes that. Maybe they mean we're tough dudes and we can oppress people. I don't know. At any rate, now that we have the geography settled, we go now to 2 Samuel 10, verses 7 and 8. When David heard of it, heard of all these alliances, he sent Joab and all the army, the mighty men. The sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Makkah were by themselves in the field. Now these are all the allies that came from those places I just said. Now, I said they were ringed around Israel. I don't mean they were there while they were fighting. They left their areas and came down to the place of the battle, which is not mentioned in Samuel. It's mentioned in the parallel passage in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles. Place of battle is Medeba, 1 Chronicles 19:7. It tells you that. Now, some people say that the battle was held at Rabbath Ammon, which is about 20 miles to the north. East of Medeba, I don't think so. All the commentators I looked at, Clark, Jameson, Foss, and Brown, Ellicott Pulpit Commentary, Cambridge Commentary, they all said that the battle was at Medeba, so that's where the battle's going to be. Way down here to the south of Syria, all the way down to the northern end of the tip of the Dead Sea. Now, in verse 7, David sends Joab and his mighty men. Now, that's a title. A famous band of fighters, the Mighty Men. It really ought to be the capital M, if you ask me, but it's not capitalized in the New American Standard. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible just says the Fighting Men, which doesn't really make it a proper name, but at any rate, some people have said these are a famous band of fighters. 2 Samuel 23:8, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. So maybe they were. Maybe that was a special military contingent, a guard of honor. Maybe not. But at any rate, they were considered to be very powerful, very mighty. The men, sons of Ammon, came out, and I said that's out of Medeba, and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city. Now, why did they draw up a battle line outside the city rather than staying inside the city to defend the city? Well, maybe they didn't want their Syrian mercenaries inside the city fighting with them. Those mercenaries could turn on them. Maybe they wanted to catch Joab between two armies. They say, okay, we'll come out of the city, and then the Syrians will be beyond us, and Joab will go against us, and then he'll find the Syrians in his back. Or he'll go against the Syrians and find us in his back, in his rear. But if you're going to do that strategy, of course, you got to leave the city, so that's probably why they did it. We go now to 2 Samuel 10, verses 9 through 12. Now, when Joab saw that the battle was set against him in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans. Remember, Arameans is Syrians. Those were the allies that I just talked about. Beth Rehob, Makkah, Zobah, Tob. But the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. He said, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come to help you. Be strong, and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. All right, so Joab arrives at the scene. At Medeba, he sees two armies arrayed, split from each other, and so he ends up in between those two armies. Now, Clark says the timing of this was probably this way. Joab probably arrived and saw the Arameans and faced them first, and then all of a sudden the other army, the Ammonites, came out from the city in Joab's rear, and then Joab found himself sandwiched between the Ammonite army, which came out of the city of Medeba. But at any rate, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown and John Gill say that Joab used great judgment to start the battle against the Arameans first rather than going against the Ammonites because the Arameans were mercenaries. They were more likely to be the first to break and run. We all know that mercenaries are not fighting for their home, so they don't fight as hard. And if they broke and ran, then that would free Joab to go out and help his brother Abishai, who's fighting the Ammonites. Now Joab gives a great inspirational speech here. Be strong, Abishai, let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. It's interesting that a murderer like Joab, remember he murdered Joab in cold blood. Interesting that a murderer like Joab could still be fighting in the name of God. Well, he's saying the right words. That always goes to show there's a lot of people do things in the name of God. And they don't even know God anymore than they know Adam's house cat. We We go now to 2 Samuel 10, verses 13 and 14. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they fled before him. When the sons of Ammon saw that the Arameans fled, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. All right, here's what happened. Joab attacks first against the Aramean mercenaries, and they hightail it away north of Meniba, heading back to Syria. So then Joab turns around. He allies himself with his brother Abishai with the other half of the army, and together they attack, probably to the south, I would imagine. They attack the Ammonites. The Ammonites decide they've had enough, and they flee back into the city to the protection of the walls. Now, Joab could have besieged the city of Meniba, but he didn't. He returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. The question is why didn't Joab lay siege to Meniba? Well, Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it's because it was not the proper time of the year for a siege. We do know that in the next spring, David sent Joab for another foray against the sons of Ammon, 2 Samuel 11:1. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. So Meniba first, Rabbah next. That Rabbah is Ramoth-Ammon, present-day Ammon. David stayed at Jerusalem while Joab went out. So Joab came back in the spring and took care of the Ammonites by hitting their capital city. We go down to 2 Samuel 10, verses 15 and 16. When the Arameans saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. All right, so now Joab's already taken care, Joab and Abishai have taken care of the Ammonites. But now they want to take care of the Ammonites, Aramean, Syrian allies. So the Arameans, after being scattered, they gathered themselves together. In other words, they reconcentrated. Verse 16, and Hadadezer, he's the big dude, he's the guy in charge of the Syrians, and Hadadezer sent and brought out the Arameans who were beyond the river. And I assume beyond the river means east of the Euphrates River. The river is the Euphrates. Beyond sounds like east. And of course, that's Syria. So Hadadezer gets out the Arameans who are beyond the river, Syria. And I guess I'm assuming he's still in charge of the Syrians from Beth-Rahob, Makkah, Zobab, and Tob. Those places I just told you about. Sounds like he got some more Arameans who were from the east of the river, which had not fought before, down there at Meniba. So all of these Syrians came to a place called Helam, and Hadadezer had his general Shobak in charge of the Syrian allies, in charge at a place called Helam where the battle was. Now this army is said to be, by Jameson, Foster, and Brown, a vast army. I don't know why he knows that. I guess with all these allies, it's a pretty big army. But at any rate, they came to a place called Helam. Now the place of Helam is unknown. It means a place of abundance. Well, there's going to be an abundance of defeat there in just a minute. Easton says it's a place on the east of Jordan and west of the Euphrates, where David gained a great victory over the Syrian army. Well, that's sort of a general placement of the city. The place is really unknown, according to Barnes and Ellicott. Ellicott says it is plain that it was in the general direction of the Euphrates and not very far from Hamath. Now, Hamath is on the Orontes River, north of the two Lebanon ranges. And if you look at the map, you go from Hamath to Euphrates. Hamath in present-day Lebanon. Go east, you hit Euphrates River. That's Syria. And that's generally where it was. That's where Helam was. We go down to verses 17 through 19, and we'll finish this chapter. 2 Samuel 10. Now, when it was told David, in other words, when David was informed of the Syrian alliance that had gathered together at Helam, or Helam, David gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. Now notice David is leading the army now, not Joab. He leaves Jerusalem and heads north. Joab has come back to Jerusalem. David goes north. Doesn't say whether Joab went with David or not. You would think that if he had of traveled with David, it would have been mentioned. So I'm going to assume that he's, I don't know whether I should assume that or not. He might be in Jerusalem. He might be with David. At any rate, David goes to Helam, and the Arameans arrayed themselves to meet David and fought against him. But the Arameans fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers of the Arameans and 40,000 horsemen and struck down Shobak, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings, servants of Hadadezer, this is all the Syrian kings, who were servants of Hadadezer, saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them, probably by giving tribute to Israel. So the Arameans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. I guess that was the end of that alliance. Now, one little textual note here. David Kill, 700 Aramean charioteers. The King James says 7,000. In fact, 1 Chronicles 19:18 has 7,000 charioteers killed. How do you reconcile that? Well, there's three ways. I think the simplest way is a copyist error. But another possible way is the original text in 2 Kings says David slew 700 chariots, which of course is impossible because chariots can't be slain. So you have to supply the men of the chariots. David slew the men of 700 chariots. Well, then if you suppose there's 10 men to a chariot, and I don't know if that's reasonable, you end up with 7,000. Well, I'm not going to go with that one. I don't think that's a good way to reconcile it. Here's another option. 2 Kings records the destruction of the choicest Aramean chariots, 700 charioteers, whereas 1 Chronicles records the total destructions of all the chariots. I think that's lame, in my humble opinion. It's simply a copyist error. Let me read you from Adam Clark. Quote, "It is difficult to ascertain the right number in this and similar places. It is very probable that, in former times, the Jews expressed, as they often do now, their numbers not by words at full length, but by numeral letters. And as many of the letters bear a great similarity to each other, mistakes might easily creep in when the numeral letters came to be expressed by words at full length. This alone will account for the many mistakes which we find in the numbers in these books, and renders a mistake here very probable. The Hebrew letter Zain, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, with a dot above stands for 7,000, Nun for 700. And if you look at the Hebrew letters, which I'm looking at right now, they are very, very close. The great similarity of these letters might easily cause the one to be mistaken for the other, and so produce an error in this place." That's how I usually handle numbers difference in the Old Testament text. So easy to make manuscript errors when you're copying the manuscripts. At any rate, it was a big defeat for the bad guys, for the Syrians. Another reconciliation problem here in Samuel, 2 Samuel, it says that 40,000 horsemen were killed. In Chronicles, it has footmen that were killed. How do you reconcile that? Well, it could be they came to battle on horses and dismounted to fight. That's how they used to fight in the Middle Ages. In fact, I just read a story about how an army, I think it was of Louis XII, was fighting somebody, either the soldiers of the Holy Roman Empire or the papacy, I don't remember, Louis XII, the French king, and he had his nobles down there on cavalry, and the opposing cavalry dismounted and was ready to fight on foot. Well, these noble Frenchmen thought that was a big disgrace to be fighting a battle on foot. That's only for infantry people, for footmen. That's not for horsemen, cavalry people like us, and so they refused to fight and went back to France and conceded the battle. Well, maybe so. Maybe that's what the difference is. You could reconcile it this way. The whole number of the slain, both horsemen and footmen, was 40,000. And so Samuel just says horsemen, including all of them, was 40,000. And Chronicles says it was 40,000 foot soldiers, which included some horsemen in there. I don't know. Could be that you just add the two, 40,000 footmen in Samuel were killed and 40,000, excuse me, in Chronicles were killed and 40,000 horsemen in Samuel was killed, so a total of 80,000. I don't believe that. I just think they came to battle on horses and dismounted to fight. I think it's the easiest way to reconcile that. Now, all these casualties, and we're not just talking about casualties, we're talking about battle deaths, are recorded here for the Arameans. None are recorded for the Israelites. And oftentimes the losses of Israel's soldiers in battle are recorded in other passages, but not here. Why, perhaps, did the author of 2 Samuel not put in the Israelite casualties? Well, here's option number one. It was a public relations ploy. It makes Israel look good. It makes the Arameans look bad. Maybe. And NIV Study Bible suggests as another option, the magnitude of Israel's victory was so great, its losses were hardly worth recording. I suspect that's the true reason right there. So the Arameans, they see the writing on the wall and they make peace with Israel in verse 19. Now, the interesting thing is, by them making peace, they thus fulfill the covenant land promise made by God to Abraham and his seed, as John Gill and Adam Clark point out. They were not dispensationalists. Dispensationalists like to take this passage, Genesis 15:18, on that day. This is the Genesis 15:18 is the famous covenant with Abraham, Abram as he was called at the time. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt," that's the Wadi El Arish, down at the southern end of Israel, "as far as the great river, the river Euphrates." David has just won a battle that gives him control over the land to the river Euphrates. And so I think Gill and Clark are exactly right. Now, the reason that dispensationalists don't like to say that is because they think that Genesis 15:18 is going to be fulfilled in a future Jewish millennium. At least the classical dispensationalists believe that, and I absolutely reject that view. I don't think it's accurate at all. Now, a dispensationalist might respond and say, okay, he might concede that David made it all the way to the Euphrates, but the Abrahamic promise of land extended the land all the way south to the Wadi El Arish, the river of Egypt, and we don't know that David went that far, and I don't know that he did either. If he does, I haven't found it yet, but it doesn't matter because we know from 1 Kings 4:21 that Solomon made it all the way from the Euphrates River to the Wadi El Arish. 1 Kings 4:21. Now, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, that would be all the Syrian kingdoms, I assume, to the land of the Philistines, that's on the west, on the Mediterranean, to the border of Egypt, at the south, the Wadi El Arish. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So how do the dispensationalists get around that? They say, well, Solomon didn't really conquer the land. He just had the subordinate kingdoms bringing him tribute. He didn't actually possess and set up a government. Well, to me, that is sucking wind. When you don't have an argument, you start making fine distinctions. By the way, Abraham's promise in Genesis 15 that the land would go from the Euphrates to the Wadi El Arish is mentioned in Joshua 1:4. God speaking to Joshua, at least the part about going to the Great Sea, as far as going to the Euphrates River is mentioned. Joshua 1:4, from the wilderness of this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, and all the land of the Hittites as far as the Great Sea, that's the Mediterranean, toward the setting of the sun will be your territory. So, famous promise, David helped fulfill it. Now, let's finish up this chapter with a summary. Adam Clark says, thus, in the space of 19 or 20 years, David had the good fortune to finish gloriously 8 wars, all righteously undertaken and all honorably terminated. Well, I don't know if you could say good fortune, like he was lucky. It's because God was with him. Let me list the wars. This is from Adam Clark. 1, the civil war with Ishbosheth. 2, the war against the Jebusites. 3, the war against the Philistines and their allies. 4, the war against the Philistines alone. 5, the war against the Moabites. 6, the war against Hadadezer. That's the one we just looked at. 7, the war against the Idumeans. That was the previous chapter. 8, the war against the Ammonites and the Syrians. That's the one we just looked at too in this chapter. 8 wars. And Adam Clark finishes now with this statement. What glory to the monarch of Israel had not the splendor of this illustrious epoch been obscured by a complication of crimes of which one could never have even expected him capable? Adam Clark continues on by saying this. We have now done with the first part of this book, in which we find David great, glorious, and pious. We come to the second part, in which we shall have the pain to observe him fallen from God, and his horn defiled in the dust by crimes of the most flagitious nature. Let him that most assuredly standeth take heed, lest he fall. And with those solemn words of warning, we are now finished 2 Samuel chapter 10, ready to go now on our next audio to 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 27. And that will be the beginning of David's downfall. It's always a woman, isn't it? David and Bathsheba. Men cannot resist women, even though the woman that he is being seduced by or tempted by will lead to his utter downfall. Happens all the time. Happened with David. We'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.